Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to this podcast. In today's interview, we'll be talking with Mr. Chris Dodinsky of Cyber Solutions, the co-founder and CEO. Chris, welcome aboard and thank you for your time this afternoon.
Well, good afternoon, Robbie.
Yeah, we looked up your bio. We did we did quite a bit of Google searching and looked up your LinkedIn profile, and you seem to have a very deep and rich background in cybersecurity. Could you give some of the highlights of your career? Can you elaborate more of how you got into threat hunting and what intrigues you about it?
Yeah, sure. So, I started my career after I left working in the defense sector. I moved into the telecommunications space, and we were working with a lot of very large carriers. My specific role was, doing network management of extremely large networks, and we were doing things like fault management and configuration management, performance and security, the whole FCAPS type thing. And so the network traffic component really interested me from the get-go. From that particular role, I transitioned into cybersecurity, where we got into network traffic analysis and really wanted to understand, how the networks were being used or abused, what was running on them, what protocols. From a security standpoint, effectively, network visibility is one of the key pillars. To understanding how to tighten your security posture, you really need to understand how your networks are being used. And this was very intriguing to me. And so that was kind of what kicked things off for CyberHunter. We started down that network traffic analysis pathway.
Hey, sounds excellent. Now, how do you venture into CyberHunter? Is this a company that you've helped to create? Is this something that you've worked with other researchers or kind of started on your own?
Right. So after working, doing a lot of solution implementation, mostly in the high assurance space, one of the projects we were working on we were tasked with coming up with a way to provide greater network visibility into certain departments within the federal government, and we were looking at ways to do that and really tell a story about security to the network owners as well as to the CERT that was responsible for the oversight of these networks. And we had been developing this product for about 5 years or so, but what I felt was that even though we were filling a significant gap by providing a network traffic visibility and insight, I really felt that there was a bigger picture that was necessary in order to have a really solid insight into post-breach investigation, which is really what threat hunting is all about. You assume that you've been breached. Okay, now what? How do you find who's inside your network? So much of our focus and effort is always on securing the perimeter of these networks, the firewalls, and making sure that no one comes in through the front door, make sure that, the antivirus is up to date. But obviously, security is not perfect, and traditional solutions are not perfect, and people still get in, and we see it from, smallest to largest of companies, small, no-budget companies to, the highest budgets. People can get in. Security is not perfect. There's always a way in. So, we have to take a bit of a proactive approach. We have to start doing threat hunting and assuming a post-breach situation inside the network. And that was really where CyberHunter was born, was with that mandate. How do we deliver proper post-breach situation visibility to shorten the breach time? Because right now, I think, depending on who you ask, the time between breach and discovery of breach inside enterprise networks around the world can range anywhere from, 60 or 90 days to years. And, we always hear of the latest hack that's happening in the somewhere in the world called some large organization with millions or billions of records that have been released. When we find out that the adversaries have been inside their network for, dozens of months, if not, 5 years or more. So how do you, obviously, if there's an adversary inside your network for years, you don't have proper visibility. And I see that every day. We talk to people every day. We perform things that penetration testing as an example, that we know people aren't aware of what happens inside their network. And that was really the impetus behind the creation of Cyber Hunter.
Excellent. Sounds wonderful. Now, how long has Cyber Hunter Solutions been in business?
We started up in late 2016, and we're a small shop. We're very focused on doing threat hunting to begin with, and we've kind of branched out from there. But yeah, late 2016 is when we began.
Excellent. Now, I know you're based out of Ottawa, Canada, and you also have an office in New York City, but does Cyber Hunter have a presence in other countries as well?
We do business in Canada. We do business in the U.S. We're doing business in the U.K. We're working with some other countries in Europe, but predominantly really, U.S. and Canada. That's the bulk of our company, our business. We are currently fairly active working some Caribbean prospects, and that's excellent as well. So, because it's so miserably cold up here, so that's good stuff.
Sure. You mean it beats Chicago, actually?
Uh-huh.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's the first I've heard. I thought Chicago was the coldest place. But maybe not. Okay. Now, here's another question. Have you tried expanding into like the APAC, Asia Pacific, or like Africa or the European countries? Really anybody could do good threat hunting. I mean,
yeah.
Have you looked at those countries as well too? Or?
Yeah, so from time to time, we will engage with partners that could be, in Australia or in the APAC region, Singapore. That's kind of the extent of it. We really haven't gone too far. I think it's just an overextension for us. And in all honesty, Ravi, we have enough business to keep us running, 120% of capacity all the time, just almost being local. So it's hard to want to reach out beyond your, at least your continent at the moment.
Yeah, that's understandable. Now, who is your typical customer base that you're trying to target? The small and medium-sized businesses, the larger companies, like the Fortune 100 to 500, or some mixture of both? Because really,
it's a little bit of a mixture.
Any,
yeah, sorry. It's a little bit of a mixture.
I think any organization, even a small, like a mom-and-pop shop, could use a good pen testing, exercise, so that's...
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We get a lot of startups, a ton of startup companies that, they've typically landed a large client or a large initial customer. And, that customer is large enterprise, is Fortune 500 or Fortune 100. They have a risk team and they want to make sure that security due diligence has been done on a product or a service or whatever it is that's going on. So we do get a lot of startups doing, web application pen testings. They have some SaaS portal or they've got a new, a new online application. There's a lot of that. Beyond that, I would say medium-sized, mid-sized, small, mid-enterprise would be kind of where we hit, because these are companies that are large enough to take security seriously. They've typically outgrown the ability to dump security onto IT staff. They kind of need to transition to a separate security team, and usually that's a bit of a challenge for that medium-sized business. And so they don't have either the, you know, the expertise, maybe they don't have the staff, maybe, and they want to improve their security posture, but they want to do it in kind of a well-balanced way, and they don't want to just start hiring for the sake of hiring. They want to do it in a smart way. The larger companies are certainly there. We have some large, you know, Fortune 100 companies for sure. But I typically find that what they're looking for is it's a very narrow gap in terms of the coverage that they have. You know, the gaps in their security stack are extremely narrow. So if we try to present something that's a little broader in scope, it's kind of, they feel that it's overlap. Right? We've already got this, we already got that, we're already doing this and that. We want someone to do this very, very little specific thing. And that's fine too. But I think mid-sized companies are kind of that sweet spot. As you get too small, you know, people just don't have the staff or the budget or the inclination to focus on security, and they just hope that they're doing things in the right way. And they do rely a lot on cloud to protect them. That's not really a good way to do it. But, you know, I talk to a lot of small businesses and they say, well, aren't I safe? You know, I'm using Amazon or I'm using Google Cloud, or, you know, they don't understand that it's just platform. It's not platform plus security. So.
Now let's get into your product service line. It looks like that you have distinct, you know, like pen testing, red team, purple team exercises, threat hunting, logging, monitoring, secure auditing, and, you know, blue team augmentation. Can you please elaborate more on those? And maybe if I'm missing things, can you please kind of explain that too, if I missed any areas?
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, as I said earlier, we started off doing threat hunting. Threat hunting, when we're talking about doing proactive threat hunting, it was, you know, when we started it, it's still a little bit ahead of its time. You know, because you really can't do threat hunting until you have a certain level of security maturity. People are still generally buying, you know, firewall services and, you know, endpoint protection services like antivirus, and, you know, they're more focused on IT provisioning and just general IT services. So threat hunting is kind of one of those things that's they feel sometimes that it's a nice to have, and so. We shifted a little bit from threat hunting to more practical service offerings like penetration testing, which we do a whole lot of. Red team or purple team exercises, that would be, you know, assuming a post-breach situation and either acting like a simulated adversary or working with a security team as we do specific things to see whether we can be stopped. If we can't be stopped, can we be seen? If you're not stopped and you're not seen, well, then you've got a gap, right? So penetration testing, the red teaming, that sort of stuff is all very complementary to threat hunting, as is logging and monitoring. You know, obviously, without proper logging and monitoring, you don't have proper visibility. And without proper visibility, well, you're kind of dead in the water. So security auditing, again, is one of those low-hanging pieces of fruit. If you have a firewall and it's not been configured properly, well, it's not going to do its job. So making sure that all these things are running properly is essential. And then, of course, blue team augmentation is going in and doing an assessment around, you know, how well is your blue team? You know, do you have a SOC or have you outsourced it? And if you've outsourced it to an MSSP, are they doing a good job for you? You know, if we went and performed a pen test, did they see us? Did they call you? Did they do anything, right? So, you know, these are kind of services that all feed into each other. They're all very complementary. They're all part and parcel of the same thing, which is really improving the security posture. On top of that, we do also resell specific services or specific products, I should say, that really, not many, but they're very focused on things that I would say, you know, if you do these things, you really are cutting down your exposure for things like ransomware. You know, I find that there's four products out there that if you really implemented these things, you would really be the toughest guy on the block here to do this. So we also sell products that kind of fit into that mold as well.
Okay, excellent. Now, as a cybersecurity journalist, I've written a ton of articles for one of my bigger clients I used to have on pen testing, and one of them was on the tools of the pen tester, like the Wireshark, the Metasploit.
Yeah.
Could you tell us more about the tools, the techniques that you specifically use for your clients when you do your pen testing?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly usually start with something like Kali Linux. It's got a suite of tools in there that are really good for the various things when you're doing reconnaissance and you're doing enumeration and, you're doing that initial data gathering. Of course, if you're doing web application testing, you want something like Burp Suite, where you can be that, you're executing the web application and intercepting the command and response, and you're manipulating that, so you can really get in there as a man in the middle between browser and application server. So those sorts of things are good. Depending on if we're doing a post breach engagement where we're doing a red team or a purple team, we want to use tools like establishing things like covert tunnels, so that we can do command and control over DNS or ICMP tunnels or HTTPS or anything like that. So we're always looking for tools in the tool bag to do various components. Love Cobalt Strike as well. It's kind of visual way of building out a command and control infrastructure and delivering payload and delivering web injects and things like that. It's an excellent tool. So there are a lot of things. Every tester that we have kind of has their own tool bag. They have their own custom scripts, but I think predominantly, we start with a Kali Linux type framework. We use Burp Suite. We use Metasploit. We use Nmap for, doing that recon. We do, packet analysis with Wireshark or other. There's a lot of great stuff out there. And, the nice thing is that a lot of the really good stuff is open sourced and community supported. You don't have to pay tens of thousands of dollars to get these solutions to do this. And so it's really just a question of finding the right fit for what you're doing. It certainly takes a lot of practice and a lot of time and effort to master these things, but very, very useful, and there's some great products out there.
Yeah, sounds wonderful. Now, can you talk a bit more why your services are really even needed to the enterprise? I mean, obviously to us it's important because we've been doing this for a while, but to our audience who may not even know anything about pen testing, can you explain to them why it's important? I mean, would it be kind of like analogous to doing like an angiogram on your heart to see like where the blockages are at? I mean, would it be kind of like that, or? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's like going to the doctor, going to the mechanic, right? I mean, you need someone to assess your network. And this is where, I think doing pen testing and doing red team type testing is absolutely essential. It's kind of, if you really want to do a level set and see where you are, let somebody do a pen test, or better yet, a red team engagement where you're starting from that toehold inside the network. Okay. You've assumed that somebody has opened the wrong email attachment, or they've browsed to the wrong website, or, they've plugged in a random USB stick that they found on the ground and somehow they become compromised. Okay. So now they're an insider. So, I talked to a couple of buddies of mine that are real hardcore hackers, and I just asked them, is there anywhere that you can't get in given enough time and energy? And they all say, no, you give me enough time and energy, I will get into your network. So if you're a target, you've got to take that, You've got to make that assumption. You've got to assume a post-breach situation, and you must work on, well, what do I do? Okay, so now I've got an infected system inside my network. Can I see it? Can I see what's going on? I mean, and it really comes down to almost 100% of the time, I find that a lack of visibility is the number one thing that is causing all of these issues. Or if there is visibility, then what we have is typically in the case of usually more large enterprise, we have alarm overload or alert overload. So they did see it, but it was lost right in the noise of everybody else and every other technology and the, you know, the hundreds of pieces of security that are just yapping all the time. And they didn't see what was important. So you've got a blend of either total lack of visibility of these adversarial movements, or you see it, but it's drowned out in the noise. So when we do these tests, when we do these engagements, and I like to focus on red teaming because it is so realistic. It's a benign way to see whether you're up to the threat of an APT or if an adversary has breached your network, and it's going to happen. What do you do about it? What is it? Are you capable of handling that? Can you see it? Can you stop it? Can you react to it? That's really what it comes down to. And so when we talk to companies, and this is circles back to why I even got into it in the first place, when we started talking to customers about things and we just asked them very basic questions like, you know, how many systems do you have on your network? I don't know. Okay, let's talk about applications. Do you know all the apps that are running? Oh, yeah, no, I'm pretty sure it's this, this, and this, and this. And then we go in and do an analysis, and they're so far out of whack with what they think is reality. You know, if they don't even have a proper inventory, how can you possibly defend that critical infrastructure or that critical data set? And so the lack of visibility is just staggering. And we see it when we do red teaming, because red teaming, you've already breached that outer shell, that hardened perimeter. And you're now on the inside, and you're now acting like a trusted insider. So, you know, 99% of the time, no one sees anything when we're on the inside. Because what a hacker will typically do is they will use, let's say we're talking about a Windows network, okay? Because still a lot of mid-sized enterprise are still all, you know, Windows. If there's a hacker on the inside and they've breached some system, well, they don't really need to pull out their bag of tools that are easily detectable or easily, stoppable by a host intrusion prevention or some endpoint protection. You can start using commands that are Windows commands, like dir, okay? Where am I, right? Who am I? What are my privileges? What's in my directory here? What's in my network? So I can start executing these commands. If you're in Windows 7, you would typically type at. If you're in Windows 8, 1, or 10, you're going to type schedule tasks. This is what's done most of the time, because if you could imagine when a system is compromised, the hacker really doesn't know where they are. It's like landing in a room in the dark. Okay, you know you landed there, but you have no idea where you are. You don't know what really, you know, what's on your system. Is it anything good? Did I get into something juicy, or is it just some, you know, low level system that has no privilege? What's around me? Is there, you know, are there any unprotected file shares? Are there some nice databases that I can access? Can I start sniffing the traffic going over the wire? Can I start laterally moving? And the thing is that a hacker that's doing pen testing will use commands that are considered benign by most security tools. You know, these are Windows utilities. They're not foreign utilities. So, you know, it's just, hey, you should be able to use these, right? Well, that's really the problem. When an adversary blends into the network and looks, you know, they match the heartbeat or the fingerprint of the network, it's really tough to find these guys. So visibility is just this number one thing. If you're not looking in the right direction, if you're not applying multiple lenses of inspection to various things, so you're not looking at network traffic, you're not analyzing it for things like command and control and beaconing and callouts and things like that. If you're not doing proper event logging, if you're not doing proper file integrity monitoring, you know, if you're not doing these things and analyzing it and actually reacting to the things that you see, then, you know, a hacker can move wherever they want, do whatever they want, exfiltrate whatever they want, and that's really what happens. Even though I would say that, you know, there's a lot of statistics out there about organizations and networks being compromised, I would say there's a whole lot more that have been compromised and they didn't even know it, you know, because it just, once you get past that outer shell, everything is fair game. And typically what we find, our evidence, which would state that we're almost invisible when we're on the inside. So.
Okay. Wow, that sounds really good. Now, when you say lack of visibility, what are you referring to specifically?
Yeah. Well, you know, it comes down to, it's really, when you talk about a persistent threat attack cycle, you know, an adversary would go through a few different stages, you know, through reconnaissance, and they go through scanning and enumeration to find out, you know, what's around, the topology of things. They would gain initial access. They would escalate privilege. You know, then they're talking about, you're talking about maintaining access. So, how does an adversary talk to an infected host? Well, typically they can't talk from the outside to the inside. You know, you can't talk from, you know, that malicious server in Europe into the network in the United States. It usually is the other way around. You infect the machine in the United States, it calls home and it says, hey, I'm awake, what do you want me to do? And it will wake up every few minutes, every few seconds, every few hours, whatever it's been programmed to do, and it will call home and ask for instructions. It will pull back instructions if there are any, and it will execute that. It will gather information, and then it will send them back home. So if you're not, as an example, watching for that sort of command and control and beaconing in the network traffic, there's a type of visibility that you should be looking for, because that, you know, unless someone is just doing sneaker net type information where you're smuggling information in and out of a USB stick, it has to be done that way. There's no way to avoid command and control if you are trying to hack a network from the outside. You have to do it that way. So if you're not watching the network traffic, well, there's one piece there's one gap. If you're not watching what your what's happening when people are issuing commands, there's another one. So as people walk through, like if you don't have your audit policy, you know, again, going back to a Windows network, if you don't have your audit policy properly configured, and you're not running things like Sysmon on your network, on your endpoints, you're not going to get things like process executions and connection requests and logon information and, you know, object access information. All these things are steps that are executed when someone lands on a host and does something. And, you know, you've got to have proper event logging. And you know, again, frequently we go into organizations that are mid-size, even large-size, and they don't have proper logging enabled. It's just too much information. It's too expensive to store it. And I get it. If you don't know what you're looking for, it's an overwhelming thing, because if you're not hunting through these logs and you don't have a recipe for understanding what to look for, then it's just a massive amount of noise, and it's a massive amount of expensive noise. It's extremely expensive to collect and house and store and process all of this information in an enterprise, in a large enterprise. So a lot of times the audit policies and event logging is not, it's not enabled properly. And if it's not enabled properly, well, then you don't have visibility of your endpoint behavior. So, as I say, you've got to be looking at your network traffic, you've got to be looking at your endpoint behavior, and you've got to put those two things together. And when you start to stack up all of that information and you start looking at it, there's no absolutes. It's very difficult to find one thing and go with absolute certainty, we know this system is compromised. No, what you're doing is you're kind of getting evidence and you're stacking up all that evidence and you're kind of going, yeah, there's probably a real issue here. I'm seeing a lot of suspicious behavior in the network traffic. I'm seeing some unusual activity in the event logs. I'm seeing some things like, let's say I saw somebody disable event log or clear some logs. Okay, well, obviously there's something. Oh, I saw somebody turned off their antivirus. Oh, obviously there's something. You know, these are suspicious activities. You don't have absolutes. There's no real, there's no real perp that you can see that's just fired a gun. What you're looking for is evidence that something has happened. Start stacking it up, and then you have to go deeper. So you need that 100,000 foot elevation view where you're taking in network traffic, you're taking in endpoint behavior, and then when you see something that is suspect, you've got to do that deep dive. You've got to look right into the endpoint for indicators of compromise, presence of backdoors. You've got to look for manipulation of the operating system and evasion techniques and persistent mechanisms and things that are kind of deep, deep down and things that you can't really do at scale very easily all the time. So you need that blend of high altitude, low altitude visibility. But it starts with traffic analysis and it starts with event logging. If you at least have that covered, then, you know, someone can make some sense out of it. You don't have it at all and you get breached, you're kind of out of luck. You'd have to go in after the fact and try to find, you know someone has been hacked. Okay, fine, we've identified that system, but what else in your network has been hit? Well, at that point, it makes it more difficult because there is no evidence to start gathering. You have to go deep dive hunting, and it takes time.
Now, kind of segue to this question, Chris and I are going to be co-authoring a book together on web app security. It's going to be published sometime, I think, next summer or in the early fall. And one of the chapters Chris is going to write about is about threat hunting. So with that in mind, Chris, how do you go about performing a threat hunting engagement? Maybe you could give us a preview to the chapter that you're going to be writing on.
Yeah, so, you know, there's a couple of ways to do it, but you know, it really does feed into what I was just saying. If we go into a threat hunting engagement and there is nothing, you know, there's no evidence to inspect, then we have to do it in a different manner. So imagine that someone gets breached. Well, how do you typically know that? Well, maybe it's ransomware, and so all of your files have been encrypted, and you got the little the ransomware pop-up saying everything's encrypted and you got to send me $400 in Bitcoin or we're going to delete everything and you've got 24 hours. Well, okay, that's an obvious one. you've been breached and you're being held ransom. But and so if we're doing a threat hunt, obviously we can do an investigation into something like that. But the real question is, because if you think about if I were a clever hacker and I breach a network and I land on a system, well, am I just going to be happy performing ransomware right on that system and then that's it? No, I'm going to plant a few beachheads all around the network. A, so that if someone finds me on one system, I can still come and go onto another system. I'm going to make sure that I can get back in. I'm going to make sure that my tracks are covered and I have a secret way back in that, you know, that maybe it wakes up once every 25 hours and calls home and I have to be a bit patient with it. But I know, because most SIM technology, which is security information and event management, which are basically log analysis type systems, a lot of times they deal with information that are in batches of 24 hours. So I know if I wake up and call home every 25 hours or 26 hours, I'm not really going to be seen every day. I'm not, you know, I've kind of exceeded the cycle of traffic analysis there. And so it would be very difficult to find me. or maybe I'm, you know, doing something extremely covert and I'm tunneling out through DNS messaging, or I'm tunneling out through SSL and they have no SSL inspection techniques. But my point is, you're not just going to land on one endpoint and stop there. You're going to spread around a bit. You're going to make a few backdoors here and there. You're going to clean up your tracks where necessary, but you're going to give yourself a level of robustness so that if one channel gets closed down, you've got another. You might have different command and control infrastructure that has been set up so that, you know, one server in the AWS cloud is talking to one infected machine and you've got another one in the Google cloud talking to another one, so that people can't really easily put those things together. So anyway, you've spread yourself around. So if we're going into a threat hunting engagement, we've got to take that into consideration, right? So we can work with the infected machine and we can try to analyze the malicious entity that might be on there, and we can sandbox it and detonate it and see if, you know, where is it calling out to. But then we have to start analyzing the rest of the network. So if this piece of malware is calling home to an AWS server over here with this IP address, who else in the network is going there? Well, we have to instrument things to do that. We would have to put network visibility systems in place to see that. Then we would have to do, we'd probably have to enable logging to see whether things are going on. So kind of the first thing that we're doing when you're going into a threat hunting engagement is assessing the level of visibility that the client has. You know, it's like, think about it this way. If your home gets broken into and someone crawls in through your basement and walks up the stairs and sits on the, you know, on the sofa in the living room, okay, fine, great. But if you're not looking inside the room, you're just walking around the perimeter, sealing the doors and windows, hoping that no one else is going to get in. You're not looking inside. You're not looking at those activities. Well, you're not going to see it, right? It's the same. And that's typically what happens. So I keep going back to visibility because it's so essential to security. You don't have visibility, you're not going to be able to find these things. You can wipe systems and hope that there's nothing else that's been infected. But then what? Are you going to, you know, 2 months later, the adversary decides to go at it again? Let's say you've paid the ransom. Well, now they know you're going to pay, so I'm going to hit you again, and you're going to pay again. And that happens a lot. So when we're performing a threat hunting engagement, we are really talking about assessing the visibility, enabling visibility where there are gaps, and then, you know, assessing things at that 100,000-foot level. We need to see whether there's a spread of infection. We need to know what's going on. We need to be watching every little thing that the infected machine is doing. We need to be watching to see whether that command and control server that they're reaching out to is being talked to by anybody else. Anything that is in that post-breach that post-breach phase of maintaining access is probably the easiest way to do that. But, you know, you have to enable proper logging as well, because adversaries will delete logs, they will delete history, and they will cover their tracks. So being aware of that and being aware of that type of behavior is essential as well. But it's really about finding the spread and seeing if it's contained. So other than that, it takes some tools, it takes privilege, and it takes trust by the client. So when we get called in to do a threat hunting engagement, you know, you're kind of handing over the keys to your kingdom to someone that you've never met before and hopefully trust. So there is a bit of that as well.
Right. Now, do your clients, or do you, now there could be legal, now when you do a threat hunting exercise, obviously there are some legal implications involved. You know, like if you engage in an activity that the client didn't specify, or you did an exercise and something went wrong, and how do you like handle the legal aspects? Do you have a detailed contract for that, or how do you handle it?
So certainly scoping the exercise is essential. You know, what's in scope, what's out of scope, what can we do, what can we not do, and the creation of effectively what-if type scenarios. So you know, if we see something, here's what we are going to do. If we see this, then we must notify the customer immediately to get permission to proceed. If we see this, you know, it's a lot of almost laying out different use cases, because you're absolutely right. I mean, we're being given privilege to go in and look into all the dark corners of the network and the endpoints. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of sensitive information there. There's a lot of power as well to potentially do damage. So we have to be very careful with what we're doing. We have to be very diligent about data management and handling of data. We have to make sure that, you know, we're securing it properly. We're encrypting it properly. If we're housing it off-site and it's very sensitive, we have to be very cautious that we delete it properly. You know, everything, you have to take a lot of steps and a lot of care when you're doing these things, and tread very lightly. Because the last thing that you want to do is do something that's disruptive to the network or to the business. And then, you know, that said, there's also no guarantees. That's, I think, the other real thing is,
right,
threat hunting. When you're doing threat hunting, you are trying to find something that your existing security stack didn't see. Okay, so there's no guarantee that we're going to find it. But as an example, you know, I think there are 150 different locations on a brand new, fully patched Windows system that malware can hide. Okay, so if we look in all those places, does that mean there's no other spots that it can hide? No, I mean, there can be persistence mechanisms in place to reestablish itself. It can run once. It can be a memory inject. It can be, there's lots of things that can be done to obfuscate, to hide, to be stealthy, to melt in, to do these things. So there's no guarantee that a hunting engagement is going to turn up anything. And I think that's, you know, one of the unfortunate things is it's always just a race to see if you can keep up to the bad guys, right? It's a tough game, but there's no guarantees. But we are really, you know, you go in with that, we'll do our best. We understand what the objectives are. We understand what the scope is. We understand where we can go, what we can do, what we cannot do. And here's what we're going to try to determine. We're going to try to determine whether, you know, this 1, 2, 3, 10 systems that are infected are the only, you know, that's it. Everything else is clean. That's really the engagement, right? It's very few times do people really want to know the ins and outs of the malware. They really just want it to go away. You know, make my problem go away, fix my problem. They don't need to know that, you know, the specifics of how it happened and how it didn't happen, because there's a lot of times they just don't have the capacity to do anything about it. Fine tuning their security stack is sometimes impossible, right? How would you, if you knew the tools and techniques and procedures that a piece of malware was using, how would you fine tune your off the shelf antivirus to look at it other than to put a signature in it? You really wouldn't, but changing the signature is really simple. So, you know, it's just make my problem go away. So I think it really, how do you perform a threat hunt? Well, you know, it starts with understanding the objective and scoping what we're going to do, treading very lightly, and understanding that we're really going to do a best effort to try and view and identify any containment and infection.
Okay. Now, if people want to improve their security posture and they want to start first with the visibility into their network infrastructure, where do they start within that?
Yeah. So I think the very first thing that I would say is, you know, in a Windows network, you turn on and collect security logs. You would also, you can use tools like, you know, Security Onion or Bro, which is now called Zeek, by the way, or something along those lines that either are an IDS, intrusion detection system, or a network traffic analysis framework, which Zeek is that. You know, you can start turning on these types of tools to start collecting your logs, start analyzing your traffic. I think the difficulty with all of these, that would be the very first thing that I would do, is I would increase my automated logging and data gathering. You have to do that. So if you've turned on your logging and you've turned on your analysis of network traffic, well, now you have to start fine-tuning it. You have to start filtering out the noise so that, you know, what we said earlier, a lot of times in these big hacks that you read about, like Target, well, what I understand is, that the alerts did come in. The security team was aware. We did see these things come in, but they were potentially lost in the noise. So you've got to reduce the noise. You can't react to thousands and thousands or hundreds of thousands of alerts. It's just, it doesn't make any sense. Pretty soon you just go numb to it and you ignore it all. So if you're trying to improve your security posture, you've got to turn on the right amount of logging. You've got to start analyzing your network traffic. But you've got to understand what's normal and what's good, because that's what you've got to filter out. Because you just want to react to things that are new. New things don't mean bad things. New things being, it's anomalous. It needs to be investigated because there's something new here I've never seen before. Is it good? Is it bad? That's important. There is no magic alarm that comes in and says, hey, you're absolutely 100% infected here. Unless, of course, you see malware on the endpoint detonate and it does something. Everything else is just suspicion. So you must improve your visibility in the logging sense and in the network traffic analysis. As I say, network traffic, that's easy. You get yourself an IDS, Snort or Suricata or Security Onion, or use something like Bro or now called Zeek. Great. Those are awesome tools for that. Logging is logging. You turn it on the endpoint. You in a Windows network, you would enable security logging. You would collect that in a Windows event collector. You would start to analyze that stuff. You would start to write use cases. If I see this and this and this or this, ring a bell, right? It just takes time to, sometimes it's just all generic, but maybe let's say 85% of the use cases are generic, but that 15% of the time is unique to the environment. And that's really where you're gonna see the biggest bang for your buck. I think the other thing that I would say is really important when you are looking to improve your security posture is take advantage of doing regular penetration tests or regular red team engagements or purple team exercises. Because when you do these things, you expose, it's not like if you wanted to just do scanning and patching. So you're just scanning for vulnerabilities and you're going to get a big list of vulnerabilities that are theoretically exploitable and we're going to go and we're going to patch them all. That's great, but that doesn't tell you the real operational threat to your environment. All it says is you're theoretically vulnerable to exploit if, the moon is in the southern sky and, it's a Wednesday. If you do a pen test or a red team engagement, you are actually testing your security controls, your security detection, and your response plans. So this is why I think it's so important to do these things on a regular basis. It is, you're paying for someone to gently and ethically hack your network like an adversary, and you're going to work with that organization, or you should be able to work with that organization to tighten your security and say, look, I did this, I did this, I did this, I did this. You saw none of it. In order to see it, you're going to need to enable these types of logs. You're going to analyze this and look specifically for this and that and this and that. And the more that you do that, the more that you have that iterative test my network, tighten my network, test my network, tighten my network type back and forth engagement, it just your posture improves and improves and improves. And it might be painful in the beginning because it's something new, right? It's something that you haven't done before, but if you're taking security seriously, that's really where you should start.
Excellent. Now, could you explain to our audience what's red, blue, and purple teaming, and what are the roles of each of these teams?
Sure. So, in a nutshell, a red team simulates an attacking team, an attacker, an adversary. A blue team is the defensive team. It's your security. It's your security analyst. It's your SOC or your security operations center. So the red team fights against the blue team. Okay, it's that's typically the way it is. So a red team engagement is you become an adversary, and the organization, you hope that the blue team sees you and stops you. Purple teaming exercise is actually when you work as a red team, you work with the blue team. And you say things like, okay, guys, I'm about to launch this attack. Did you see it? Okay, no. Okay, so now you didn't see it, so I think we need to adjust here and tweak there and do this and do that. I'm going to do it again. Okay, did you see it? Yes, you saw it. Okay, let's move on. And so as you work on a red team and you work through the kill chain effectively, which you have to do. By the way, if anybody wants to look at this stuff, there's something called the MITRE Attack Matrix. And MITRE, M-I-T-R-E, the attack matrix, A-T-T-C, what is it, A-T-T-A-C-K, but the A is an ampersand, the second A is an ampersand, stands for adversarial tools, techniques, and common knowledge. It is an excellent matrix that really shows you all of the things that someone could do when they're performing as an adversary. And what you want to have as a security team or as a blue team, you want to have as much coverage or visibility in every one of those boxes as possible. Not that that is typically possible in any environment. It would just cost too much money and be too prohibitive and too restrictive. But you want to have good coverage. And the MITRE Attack Matrix is an excellent reference to do that. But so when you're red teaming, you're attacking. When you're blue teaming, you're defending. And when you're purple teaming, you're really working together to say, okay, what type of attack are you going to do now? I see it. Okay, thanks. Move on to the next one. Okay, great. I got it. But that's essentially what it is.
Okay. Now, in addition to these types of exercises, are there any other security solutions that you recommend for our audience? Or if you can expand on that and kind of give us your top tips of how to protect yourself from a cyber attack?
Sure. There's the typical stuff, right? If you don't do the basic stuff like use strong passwords and make sure your firewall is properly tuned and if you're not defending yourself normally and you've got the traditional stuff in place, this is really going to help. But if you've got typical controls and you've got strong passwords and multi-factor authentication and you've got a decent perimeter that's established so people they don't have direct access to your network assets, then there's kind of four things that I would recommend that people deploy. And if you do these things, you're kind of making yourself an extremely hard target. It would be very difficult to establish a foothold in your network. So the first one would be incoming email cleansing. And it's not just an email filter or a spam filter or, something like that. This is actually incoming email cleansing using something called Content Disarm and Reconstruction, CDR. Hmm. Content Disarm and Reconstruction, what it does is it assumes every single email attachment is malicious. And it runs it through its CDR engine. And if it sees active code buried deep inside that Microsoft Office document or that PDF document, it jumbles that code up and then neutralizes it. So it can't execute when it gets through the other side. So every single attachment is cleansed or neutralized before it comes into your network. So obviously that stops. We've run these solutions through their paces. They're awesome with existing malware, with 0 days, with things, anything embedded into your documents or your attachments, this will cleanse, okay, and neutralize. So the great thing about that is that it eliminates one of the two phishing vectors off the table. The second one I would say is something called remote browser isolation. When you're sitting inside your organization or your network and you're browsing, you've opened up your web browser and you're going out to the world and you're, you know, when you hit one website, you're really hitting like 50 websites. You've got ad servers and trackers and this is and that's, and you know, you're inundated with different web connections. You don't really have the ability to trust them all. You could have a malicious ad server sending you something. And if you go to the wrong website, your browser can be hooked. You can, you know, you can have some sort of JavaScript inject. You can do things. You know, we can take over your browser. We can execute various commands in that web browser to make you do things, make you download things, make you enter credentials. You know, there's all kinds of different things that we can do. Remote browser isolation has kind of what I would call it a sacrificial lamb that browses for you. And you have a video connection. It's the streaming video to that browser. So you're remotely controlling a browser that browses for you. And so anything malicious that happens to you when you're browsing stops right there. It doesn't touch your endpoint. Remote browser isolation takes that other phishing vector off the map. So if someone sends you a malicious link, oh well, I've instructed my remote browser to do that for me. It got infected. It didn't go into my network. It stayed out there. To me, those two things are essential. The next one would be weaponized media. Okay, so if you are, if we're doing a social engineering engagement and we're trying to attack a company, one of the ways might be we might leave memory sticks, USB sticks, you know, in the bathroom or in the parking lot or in the smoking area or something, and maybe we label them XXX honeymoon videos. Well, you know, I know someone is going to plug that in eventually. And if someone plugs in the wrong USB stick, well, then we've got a toehold inside the network. So I would say weaponized media prevention. So things that restrict the use of removable media, or looks for things like keyloggers, looks for things like if you've ever heard of a bash bunny, or you've ever heard of a rubber ducky. Those are tools that can emulate keyboards, and they can inject things into the endpoints. It doesn't matter, even if your computer is locked, you just plug it into the USB port and you can get a toehold and it can call out. So there are solutions out there that obviously prevent these things. So at this point now, if you're a hacker, you can no longer send malicious attachments. You can no longer direct people to malicious websites, and you can no longer drop removable media or weaponized media into your network. Okay, well, now it's very difficult. So how else am I going to get in? How else am I going to do something to gain that toehold? So, and then of course, the other thing I would say that would be maybe the fourth thing to look at, in addition to all the other normal stuff like strong passwords and all that good stuff, would be a web application firewall. This is not a firewall. This is a web application firewall. So no one can get to your website without going through a web application firewall. So if you have an online store, or you've got a lot of, if you've got a web app or a portal out there, and you want to protect it from being hacked, you put a web application firewall in front of it, and it scrubs anybody from getting to the actual web app with malicious things like SQL injections and cross-site scripting and all those types of attacks. You know, if you do those four things, in addition to normal security, you've just made my job as a hacker, if I'm a hacker, really, really difficult. So I would start there. And then, of course, because nothing is perfect, some clever individual is going to find a way to bypass these things. That's what threat hunting is about, right? Threat hunting even exists as a topic because security solutions are not perfect. You need to be able to find the things that are evading your security. So if you do these things, it's very difficult, but still, it is not perfect. There will be other ways. So.
Okay. Now, do you feel that your approach can truly help stop things like the ransomware, the cryptojacking, you know, and other APTs like that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. As I say, this will make you the hardest target on the block if you did that. But nothing is perfect. If we found the perfect solution, we could all go home. So I do, however, think that, you know, still, I think something like over 90% of all breaches happen through email attacks. Okay, so if I use content disarm and reconstruction to scrub attachments and remote browser isolation so that I can go ahead and click any link I want and not hurt myself, well, then I've just taken phishing off the table. So I've just removed over 90% of all the threat vectors. So now what are you going to do, right? You're just continuing to reduce the attack surface in your organization. And the more you harden it, and the more that you're aware of everything that is abnormal, well, then you're way ahead of the game.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, in terms of the cyber threat landscape, this is one of my most favorite questions to ask all my guests. We have the Internet of Things, you know, mobile convergence, you know, where you bring your own device, you know, for like smartphones, distributed data repositories, you know, we talk about data leaks, data breaches, biotech. And a big thing now, I think the biggest buzzword here in cybersecurity is AI and machine learning, both from an offensive and defensive standpoint. I know that AI can be used to, you know, really help with the threat hunting penetration testing team in terms of automating, you know, those repetitive tasks. But there's also the flip side to that, where a cyber attacker can use AI against you also. Can you elaborate on all four of these, or five of these actually, and just kind of what are your thoughts on the cyber threat landscape?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, IoT is obviously problematic because everything is getting an IP address, and security is not typically considered, you know, if you're developing a smart light bulb that you can manipulate with your mobile phone, you know, are you really putting a robust security stack on there? IoT, you know, everything is getting networked. We see ICS networks and SCADA networks that they're connecting up to the internet because they want to remotely monitor them. Well, now all of a sudden you're connecting these things that are running, you know, Windows 95 and things that had no business being on the network are all of a sudden being networked. You know, you can imagine that if you had in a resort, you have a refrigerator or a restaurant, you've got a refrigerator that is hooked up to the net somehow, and someone can hack it. And every night at midnight, they turn off the refrigeration till morning, and then you turn it back on again. Well, you're obviously going to lead to food spoilage, or maybe you're controlling chemical input into water supplies. And so, you know, networking everything is not always a good idea. It just... because security is always that unpleasantness that gets overlaid after the fact. It's all about getting the latest app out the door as quickly as possible. Putting security into it is, it's just going to slow everything down. It's going to be more difficult, more expensive. So it doesn't always get considered. So IoT is a big one. Obviously, the proliferation of IoT devices, everything being networked, it's going to be kind of crazy. It's going to be like the Wild West. Mobile convergence, BYOD, you know, that's another one of those things. You know, there are some great mobile device, security device stuff that you can put on your phone, you know, set policies and stuff, but it can be fairly cumbersome. It's not always appreciated. If I want to bring my own device that I let my organization that I'm working for get into the, you know, nooks and crannies on my phone, I don't necessarily want that. It's not expected. There's a new generation of people, millennials and younger than the latest generation, that are just going to expect to bring their devices to work. It's part of them. It's part of who they are. So that that mobile convergence, I guess, and you're bringing your own device into work and using it as a business tool, you're bringing a lot of untrusted, uncontrolled things into the environment and treating them as trusted insiders. And I think that's obviously going to be a big one. distributed data repositories and the proliferation of data. The data proliferation is going through the roof, right? We're storing and creating more data than, you know, at any time in history by orders of magnitude. Where it exists, you know, it used to be that you'd have a central location in your organization with all your critical, your crown jewels and your critical information is there. Now it's everywhere. It's everywhere. And it, again, if you go back to BYOD, it's also on these devices because they're loaded with memory. And so I'm just going to download my file share and keep it on my cell phone. Well, wonderful. But your data is everywhere, and no one really knows where it all is. That's a real issue, and I at least find that to be an issue. People have so much data proliferation, and they've got it so scattered, they have no control over where it's going. There are a lot of solutions out there like cloud access security brokers that are good at that, but again, it you have to have the corporate will to implement it, and you have to tune it. I see so many of these solutions out there that are just they're sitting in monitor mode. Well, what good is that? They're always just sort of watching. They're not alerting. They're not stopping. I just saw some sensitive data leave the network. Okay, good. You didn't do anything about it. You didn't ring any bells. You didn't leave, alarm or alert or inform. You just sort of said, there it is. There it went. Biotech and wearables, that's an avenue I'm not super familiar with, but I can see it coming. It's a bit frightening to me to see that integration, but it's going to be, to me, it's like IoT. If you start to implement a convergence between biology and technology and you start wearing implants that are, smart RFID chips or passive receivers or, even things like Google Glasses and that little experiment that didn't go super well. The biotech thing is a bit scary as well, and it comes back to, are we factoring in security through the software development lifecycle? And that's a whole other podcast on that one. AI and machine learning is interesting. I think the whole concept of AI and machine learning is a bit overhyped in the security space. Machine learning is great for anomaly detection. AI is good at doing, performing leaps of logic that humans might not have been able to do because the data sets involved are just too vast. But you still have to work with these things. There's no perfect answer, particularly on the defensive side. I think it's still a bit in the hype arena, not so much into the super useful arena beyond anomaly detection. Where I think it's going to get scary is in the offensive arena. If you think about a piece of malware that, you've breached the network, I'm sitting on an endpoint, we're already starting to see instances of malware that is watching and learning the cadence and the heartbeat and the fingerprint, if you will, of the network, because it's what it wants to do is it needs to blend in. It needs to look around and it sort of goes, what does everybody else look like? What is everybody else's behavior doing? What are all these trusted insiders doing? And where are they communicating? And how are they communicating? What protocols and ports are they using? How often are they doing it? Are they executing certain commands and certain things? It can actually fingerprint and map and make itself look very common. And if you've got malware that looks extremely common and blends into an enterprise in terms of behavior, look and feel and smell and taste and, all the rest, it's just disguised itself as the most average looking insider you've ever seen. Well, now you're in real trouble because spotting these things that have just melted into your network are going to be really, really tough. So I think, AI and machine learning used in an offensive approach is going to be the bigger cudgel, I guess, the bigger weapon. The defensive side, I don't know if the defensive side is going to be able to keep up to that. Because if you have something that looks incredibly average and incredibly boring and dull and doesn't stand out in any way, well, maybe it looks too normal, I guess. But I mean, if you have malware that just looks so average in terms of what it's doing, no one's going to ring the bells. So that one's a little bit scary, I think.
Okay.
What are your thoughts on critical infrastructure? I think I was just reading an article, I think this morning, where I think Baltimore, Maryland was hit with some kind of ransomware attack and it impacted their critical infrastructure. There's been a lot of talk about that, you know, like attacking, you know, our food supply, you know, nuclear reactors, airports, water supplies, oil, gas. What do you think of that? I mean, do you think the cyber attackers can have access to that, or what are your thoughts on it?
Well, I think these are soft targets, unfortunately. I think these networks that used to be air gapped and are now, you know, they're put onto the internet because someone wants to centrally monitor something or manipulate something or understand something. It's a real dangerous thing to do because we're creating a bunch of soft targets. You know, you hear stories about the hackers that go to shows like DEF CON and they play traffic bingo, where they hack into the traffic lights and manipulate them. And, you know, that's crazy stuff. I think these are just soft targets and it's going to be a real issue. The critical infrastructure piece is probably, I would say, any country's biggest threat right now is that. You have these industrial control systems that are a conglomeration of, you know, five or six different large vendors worth of equipment, and they've made this plant, let's say it's a refinery or something like that. Well, they all want to remotely access things to monitor and fine-tune. How do you prevent... You've now established, let's say there's half a dozen large organizations that are remotely monitoring and managing a refinery. Well, how do you've created six extreme trust relationships that have to be very tightly controlled. Well, who's measuring and testing all of those organizations when they're coming in? Who's validating what they're doing? Who's making sure that vendor A doesn't interfere with vendor B, and who's making sure that, you know, vendor C is actually trustworthy and does due diligence on the far end, and is actually the people doing stuff and getting in. Like, there's so much problem. There's so much of a footprint or of an attack surface in these large industrial control systems and these critical infrastructure networks that that's a frightening prospect for sure.
Right. Honestly, I find the IoT to be the most scary. I mean, all this interconnectivity and, like, for example, about a month ago, my financial advisor and we went to lunch, and he, I think he's got a smart car, and just with the click of his gizmo, he was able to get the car to back out automatically. I'm going, wow. And he had like four computer screens, and going, you know, Colin, what if it's like another sub-zero? You know, like we had that polar vortex, well, something freezes. I mean, your whole car is pretty much shut with all these electronics, you know? I mean, yeah. As impressive as it was, I mean, it's like literally a James Bond car. I mean, I couldn't fathom with all this connectivity. I mean, what if you're driving and some cyber attack all of a sudden takes control of your car, you know? I mean, it's possible, and that's what's scary.
Oh, so, 100% is possible.
That's why I'm glad I stick with my old Honda Civic Accord 2003, just the old analog instrumentation. I'm happy with that.
There's definitely something to be said for going old school, right? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Less things to go wrong, too.
Yeah. Now, finally, as we wrap up our show, are there any services or solutions that Cyber Hunter is going to roll out in the near future? Or in other words, what are your plans for expansion in the future?
Yeah, so... what we really want to do, we've got a lot of expertise in that post-breach analysis, and what we're doing is we're rolling out a more comprehensive solution in and around three lenses of visibility, which is the traffic analysis, event analysis, and forensic state analysis of the endpoints. We really are putting that together into sort of a security fusion type product. To me, I think it's essential. We need to have visibility into these different avenues and different data sets. Right now, what I find is that there are too many things that are siloed from everything else. and nothing is stitching it together. And so we're taking the approach of fusing together three different elements of post-breach investigation or post-breach scenario hunting to make sure that we can go into an organization, you know, flip a switch and turn on these three different lenses of visibility, not only turn them on and start gathering the information that we need, but using techniques to filter and analyze and alert on things that we know are indicative of threat actor behavior. So I think we don't have a name for it beyond, you know, just fusion or something along that line, but we've got all the piece parts and we're building out different use cases and different playbooks in each area. And of course we're putting these things all together, but I think we're going to take that skill set and that understanding and try to productize it. So we'll see how that goes.
Sounds awesome. Chris, we thank you for your time this afternoon, and we look forward to having you in the future on some other podcasts.
Great. Well, thanks, Ravi, for having me. It was a lot of hopefully I didn't ramble on too much. It was a good chat, though.
No, it was great. One of my most favorite areas is pen testing, threat hunting. And as I said, you know, we're going to be writing a book, co-authoring a book on this very subject. So stay tuned for that book. It's coming out again sometime late next summer. It'll be published. So we'll be working on getting a preview put together on our websites too. So anyways, well, Chris, thanks for your time, and we'll be in touch soon.
All right. Take care.
Bye.